Do you need an attorney? Call someone you can trust. The Broward County Bar Association, a not-for-profit organization, was founded in 1925 to foster courtesy, ethics, and professionalism, as well as to provide necessary legal services throughout South Florida. The Broward County Bar Association, 3,000 members strong, has attorney members that work throughout the entire state of Florida, as well as nationally and internationally. Remember, the Broward County Bar Association is a referral you can count on. Call the Broward County Bar Association at 954-764-8310 for all your legal needs. A referral you can count on. 954-764-8310. Or contact online at browardbar.org. Non-lawyer spokesperson.
Welcome to Legal News and Review, recipient of the Florida Bar Award of Excellence, and featuring Michael Santucci, co-chair of the Intellectual Property Division of the Broward Bar. From the law firm of Santucci Priori, practicing intellectual property, business, and entertainment law and litigation, located in downtown Fort Lauderdale. Legal News and Review, the only real problem solver radio program using the law, with your moderator, Philip Bell, and hosts and legal panel attorney, Gary Singer, chair of the Broward County Bar Association's Real Property Section. Gary Singer is board certified in real estate law and a syndicated columnist from the Sun Sentinel. He is an expert in his field of practice. Now, here's your moderator, Philip Bell.
On the docket for today's broadcast, Florida is considered a maritime state. I mean, we live on the water, and we have some of the largest ports in the whole world are in South Florida. You know, but from salvage of historic treasure vessels, and we're going to touch on that, to, of course, collisions, to even day-to-day operations, maritime law affects us here in South Florida. And we're very pleased to have board-certified and civil trial attorney Robert McIntosh from McIntosh Schwartz, PL. It's really the preeminent maritime law firm in the whole state. Robert's practice is devoted to maritime field. I'd like to welcome our legal panel host. Good afternoon, Gary Astro.
Hey, thanks for having me on again, Phil.
And, of course, good afternoon, Michael Santucci.
How are you, Phil? I want to also say hello to our listeners on 96.9 FM, 103.9 FM, and 740 AM. Loving this new format. We're on three stations simultaneously every day at 3:30.
5 days a week with rebroadcast at 12:30 every Saturday and Sunday. And let's not forget iHeart. Tune in. And iRadio Now app listeners, we appreciate you and keep those emails coming. You know, I grew up in Chicago where we have a huge lake, and I've even been on the sailboats and experienced the Mackinac race, which is really exciting, except I hate being yelled at by the by the captain, so to speak. But as a kid growing up, one of my favorite shows was Gilligan's Island. And you remember a three-hour tour, and the tiny ship got tossed. If not for the fearless crew, the crew ship would have been lost.
The Minnow.
The Minnow, that's right. Yeah. But what are the legal aspects to the skipper, who also is the owner-operator to the charter boat? We're very pleased to welcome Bob McIntosh from McIntosh Schwartz. Good afternoon, Bob.
Good afternoon, Phil. Glad to be here.
Well, you know, I was interested. I spoke to you about Gilligan's Island, and you didn't have a wasted youth like myself watching TV. But I gave you the gist. And so the question I want to start off with, and I'm sure my audience would be interested, to take fantasy and put it into real life. You know, the show Gilligan's Island is where the ship got shipwrecked because of a storm. In the real world, what is the legal ramifications? I mean, what would happen to the skipper who had five passengers and one first mate?
Well, it all depends really on whether or not the skipper was negligent. The skipper, if he had news of the storm in advance, he knew where the storm was coming, and he decided just to make a quick trip. Oh, I can beat it, kind of like beating a red light.
Right.
And the storm catches up with him. Then he would certainly have some potential liability for any accident that happened. And in addition to that, the owner has to keep the vessel in seaworthy condition. So if the vessel's in a storm and the vessel flounders because the boat wasn't properly maintained, wasn't seaworthy as the Admiralty courts say, then there's liability on the owner. So in a sense, it's not unusual different, unusually different from any other type of accident. You look at the operator and you look at the owner. And if the owner and the operator are negligent, you have a claim for negligence. The difference is it'd probably be brought in the admiralty courts.
Huh. So the captain who did not go down with the ship, and we, by the way, just real quick, you know, I told you about that story. The reason why the captain went down to the down with the ship in the 1700s and 1600s and even the 1800s was because if not, he was going to go in debtor's prison. So
wasn't that a bravery?
Yeah, it wasn't out of bravery. It was out of, hey, I don't want to go to prison.
Is that right?
Yep.
Well, let's back up a little bit for our listeners, Mr. McIntosh. What is admiralty and maritime law? What does it include? What does it not include?
Admiralty and maritime law includes any vessel operating on navigable waters. So what that really means is if you're on a boat or canoe, a cruise ship, even a military vessel, and if
and
it's
an
on,
airboat, right?
Even and an airboat. Yeah. And if it can reach navigable waters, then it falls within the admiralty jurisdiction. For instance, there are some cases that even hold a vessel was in admiralty jurisdiction, even though the vessel had to be portage, you know, lifted up out of the water and mm-hmm. carried over a beaver dam or something like mm-hmm. that. But as long as the waterway leads to the oceans, the Gulf, navigable water.
So the intercoastal counts.
Intercoastal, okay. Absolutely.
Okay.
Lake Okeechobee.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So a typical client for you would be, yacht owners, yacht clubs, yacht brokers, passengers on a cruise ship. Would that, or are those all potential clients for you?
They're all potential clients, but the area that maritime law does not cover as admiralty doesn't cover the buying and selling of a boat, mm-hmm. doesn't cover the construction of a boat. So although you might think the natural way of things,
right.
buying and selling a boat would be admiralty law, it's not. It's state law. Mm-hmm. The construction of the boat, once the boat reaches the position of being able to go and operate in the water, like it's finished, comes into the water, you may not have finished the interior of the boat, may be other things that need to be done. But once it's on its own keel, then it becomes a maritime issue. So, for instance, banks who are financing the building of yachts, they do not have a maritime lien on the yacht from the day the building begins. Their maritime lien for their ship mortgage doesn't begin until the vessel is actually operating in the water on its own keel.
Which makes some sense. I wanted to jump in here, Gary Ostrow, and I practice criminal law for more time than I'd like to admit. But
a lot of boat owners.
He's a lot older than he looks.
I was going to say, you couldn't be in a better place to practice maritime law, I would imagine. I came down here in spring break in 1975 or 76, and I never left. I said, I'm going to law school down here when I saw the yachts in the intercoastals.
And the pretty girls.
I think I noticed a couple of them, too. And I never left, and I'm still here. But my question is this. I'm not going to mention any names, but Jim Moran, whom I'm sure you know the name. Jim Moran owned
the Gallant Lady.
The Gallant. Well, he actually, the way I understood it, he owns several.
Yeah,
he does.
Gallant Ladies.
He owns several yachts.
Which are the most opulent, most ridiculous 100 foot plus foot yachts I've ever seen in my life. I've been on one. And I don't know if it's the same one because they're all the same name. They look alike. But I've been told time after time after time by every expert on the planet who thinks he is an expert and probably knows nothing. They all tell me the same thing. You know what? Moran didn't pay for that yacht. I go, what do you mean? It didn't cost him any money. I go, what do you mean it didn't cost him any money? Well, there's a way to structure it with taxes and with construction and some legal maneuvers that you're really not coming out of pocket for the or write-offs, but there's a way to structure it where, and these are people that don't know half as much as you do, or 10% of what you do. And maybe you don't know what I'm talking about, but this is, I'm just telling you.
Most of us half the time don't know, but go
right,
ahead.
Right. That's a whole other story. But is there anything that rings a bell when you hear that type of talk that could mean anything?
Absolutely
real?
Not. Absolutely not.
No basis to it. No reason to believe that it wouldn't be just as expensive. I owned a fleet of Rolls Royces that I would be paying for them one way or the other. There's no way you can structure it, whereas there's no out-of-pocket expense, and it's a write-off, where if you didn't build it, you would be giving that same money to the government, for example.
Well, I'm sure that the owner of the yacht might be using it for business expense and somehow be able to write it off. But that has nothing to do with actually paying for the yacht. The money has to come out of his pocket to pay for it. Whether or not he can take some tax advantage later on, that's something I can't.
The old adage is that it's always better to be like me, having a brother and a brother-in-law that have yachts than to
make friends
than
with
to
yachts.
Have one myself. Right. Yes,
it's a lot less pricey.
But a real issue down here has to do, and I have a friend named Lou, who actually has water frontage property right there on the intercoastal. He does lease out the slip to like, I believe it's 80 or 100 foot. I mean, it's a large space that he has there. But in speaking to Bob about this, Bob McIntosh from McIntosh and Swartz, you said that it is an issue to get that boat removed if there's non-payment. I guess it's not as easy as if I was storing it on a dry dock or in a parking lot. It's a different type of a law. But once it's in the water, what is the process? I mean,
the problem is for the dock owner or wharf owner, if he's not a marina and he's not a shipyard, that there's really no way to foreclose his maritime lien, which he has. You have a lien as a matter of law because you're leasing space on a dock to a boat. So that gives you a lien on the boat. The lien on the boat can be enforced, but you have to go into federal court to enforce it. So if the dock owner's owed only a small amount of money, say $7,000, $18,000, and the boat itself, normally if it hasn't been paying, is not worth a great deal of money, $10,000, $15,000, $20,000, by the time you go into federal court, put down the deposit for the marshal, have a custodian to take care of the boat while the suit's going on, then you spend a lot of money.
Sure.
I can't believe this issue was raised because I own in the Port Marina a boat slip. I think it can accommodate a 65-foot yacht. And I got a guy, I've had people in there for years, and I have an equitable interest in it, but I'm still paying the bank. And I got a guy who spends about $2,000 a month leasing that space from me with his boat. I think it's a 60-foot I forgot the name, the Sun something?
Sunseeker.
Sunseeker. And he hasn't been paying his bill. And I just started writing him letters and say, listen, you're three months default. You're $2,000 a month. And this question couldn't have been more on point for me because I have no idea. I'm trying to bluff the guy. You know, the sheriff's been down there and he's posting all kinds of signs on your boat. Now, they are a marina. I am the lessor. I'm leasing the boat slip to him. The landlord, I guess, theoretically. So who has the right in terms of the lien? Who would the lien holder be? And I guess I got to get a judgment against this guy?
Well, you don't have to get a judgment to arrest the boat. My thought is, since it's a marina where
Let me interrupt you. This boat is worth far more than the cost it'll take me. So I'm all in.
This is one of the few.
And you're all invited because I'm going to be driving this thing within a few months if I get the right advice, Bob. No pressure.
Can Phil dress like a pirate?
He can dress however he wants, man. He can sit with me in the front seat.
Arresting a yacht is one of the few transactions in court that you have to give the owner absolutely no notice of.
When can we start?
You file the action in court. The court looks at your documents in camera in the chambers. Routinely, the court approves your arrest documents if he knows the law firm, your maritime lawyer. He gives it to the U.S. Marshal. The U.S. Marshal goes out with the custodian you've retained. In the middle of the night, they cut the lines, take the boat.
So no judgment. That's ex parte.
Yeah,
that whole process, it's like getting a writ.
Absolutely.
So wait a minute. They seize the boat, then what? Is it up for auction? Can I bid on it? Can I steal it?
Then you have a court case. And then the owner has the opportunity to go into court and say he had no right to arrest the boat. And then if he realizes you did have a right, he owes you money for the dockage. One way he can get out of it is to put up a bond, the amount owed plus 12%. Mm-hmm. Then he takes the boat, which is good. You don't have the expense of maintaining it. And then you fight over the money that's left in the court.
Right, but the fact that I'm the lessor and there's a separate independent entity that stores the boat, cares for the boat, maintains the boat, which is the Port Marina, doesn't complicate the transaction.
It complicates it. I haven't run into that specific scenario, but my opinion is you'd have a right to foreclose it, which is different from the poor yacht owner, person who's renting the space behind his house.
Right.
Florida passed a statute to help marinas and boatyards to be be able to take care of derelict vessels that are left at their boatyards without going through the federal court.
But why ex parte? Why doesn't the owner of the boat have the opportunity to be
what
heard?
What do you think would happen if you gave the owner notice?
Oh, it's, you know, I was going to say he would take that boat right out of
Bahamas.
That slip and he'd be gone. Yeah. But I'm not. I'm going to try to avoid that possibility.
The Bahamas is 50 miles away. He'd
right.
be gone.
Right. So that's why. So I'm going ex parte.
Yeah. Gary, okay. You saw the movie Repo Man, right?
I,
Emilio Estevez.
I did.
Yeah,
I did. I learned a lot from it. Too.
I use them. They're do friends you? Of mine. I've been using them for many years. Them
who,
and their predecessors.
Being...
National Liquidators, and Bob Tony is the principal owner of the company. And they operate to act as custodian for boats that are under arrest. And they also service financial institutions that take boats on self-help.
Do you realize we just witnessed a real consultation? Things that you do all day long.
And I waive the confidentiality, which nobody seemed to care about.
Yeah, your boat owner is listening, and he's leaving tonight.
The whole problem is he's not paying attention, so I want to walk away, or actually I want to float away with the boat, if that's possible.
Now, a cool aspect of your practice, or within maritime law, is the treasure seekers, you know, and you've had some experience with that, correct?
Yes, I've had experience in two instances. I forget who was the name of the fellow that found all the treasure initially down
Mel,
in the U.S.
Mel Fisher.
He came to our office, my old office, and other maritime lawyers while he was a treasure hunter, and he was running out of money and wanted the lawyers to represent him on a contingency on the treasure. We were like, ain't going to happen, you know. Yeah. We didn't have enough sense to realize he was going to be successful. But I have represented a fellow that came into my office, and he had a cannonball from a Spanish treasure ship he had found off the coast of Juneau Beach.
Wow.
And he said it came from a treasure ship because it was made of quartz. So it wasn't just a round iron ball, but it had the, you can imagine, you know, all the chips on it and everything like
What's
that.
What's something like that worth on the market?
I don't know what the cannonball was worth, but the reason you used it is because when it hit the mast, it shattered and shrapnel went everywhere into the crew.
Also, it was more of a prehistoric can grenade.
Yeah, exactly. He never found the treasure, and I never got anything out of it except a lot of pleasure.
Is that what he told you?
Yes, you're right.
Yeah, never found anything. Sorry, Bob.
Yep, that's a story sticking to it.
Yeah.
But maritime law has a, if you will, litigation issues that is attached to it. And you devote 100% of your practice to litigation.
Well, certainly 90% of it sometimes I handle it. And, you know, there are things like limitation of liability, which people are somewhat upset about when they understand what it is. If you're the owner of a boat and you're in an accident and the boat hits another boat, badly damaged, or it sinks, and you're not aboard the boat and you're not in control of the boat, then the maritime law provides that you can limit your liability to the value of the boat after the accident.
Why is that different from the owner of a vehicle in the same circumstance, of a motor vehicle? Why isn't their liability limited in the same way? Why not?
Doesn't fit into the maritime
context.
Well,
why? I mean, any theories? Or
I do. Maritime law comes from hundreds of years.
Okay.
It was an effort to protect boating and cargo shipping, commercial shipping. Most of the maritime law you find was written primarily with the shipping of cargo in mind. For instance, unusual to maritime law is the last service provided to the boat is the first in line to get paid. You might think, well, that's not reasonable. But the maritime law looks at it from the standpoint, if you provide bunker fuel to the boat to get the boat to finally get to port to discharge its cargo, then you enabled everyone to get paid. So last in time, first in line in maritime
law. That's almost like bottle the throttle.
Oh, this is much better.
No, but we need another one of those from the next guest. No pressure.
Yep. Now, McIntosh and Schwartz, you have such a stellar reputation. We actually featured two of your attorneys over the last couple of years. One, of course, is Sean Sullivan, and then, of course, Ben Dowers. Both well-known practicing attorneys, and you know, they love you, first of all. You know, they came out and talked about you. I knew about you before you and I actually met, thanks to them. And your firm itself, you know, is really one of the premier maritime practices. Sincerely, you have a lot of business and a lot of history.
Thank you, Phil.
It's true. It's true. I know you won't say it, but it's my, you know, my job, so my audience can understand who and what you do. But you know, you experience representing a host of issues, just not individual boat owners or the accidents or the Jones Act and things along those lines. What I find fascinating is that you've represented major manufacturers in product liability litigation.
Right.
And that was on behalf of insurance underwriters and, of course, through their self-insured programs.
Absolutely.
As well.
There's a lot of litigation in boating deals with problems in the operation of the boat and the equipment. And the problems are extremely expensive to fix, and therefore it often results in litigation.
Are the liabilities, when it comes to accidents, I've seen an accident with one of those wave runners or jet skis, if you will, and you know, recently was the baseball player that, what was his name again?
Fernandez.
Down in Miami.
Yeah, yep. Exactly. And there's still, I try to find more information. They're still contemplating on what kind of charges, if anything, could be filed because of possible intoxication, you know, with legal or illegal drugs as well. But things like that do cross your desk from time to time. Is that correct?
They certainly do. Absolutely. Yeah. You get involved in boating accidents, you know, terrible situations, intoxicated boaters, mm-hmm. and you get involved in disputes with crew members. I like the stewardess who was making voodoo dolls of the other captain and putting pins in them to create. No, well, she claimed it worked, but when she fell and hurt herself, then she claimed it was the captain's fault.
Well, it actually backfired on her, it sounds like so.
Speaking of workers, my co-host Phil Bell was telling me that there's a concern amongst yacht workers or maybe even commercial cruise ship workers that if they make a claim for an injury that they're going to be blacklisted in some way and it'd be difficult to get hired again.
I think that's a legitimate claim. Mm-hmm. I have run into crew members who've had problems that claim that. I recently had a lawsuit where a large 150-foot yacht was being totally rebuilt. Renovated, really. They didn't take it apart. But the total cost ended up being about $3 million. And the owner, when he got down to everything being finished, decided, I'm not paying the last 10% to anybody. Mm-hmm. And the reason he would do that is because it's going to cost the crew mm-hmm. members or the small repair yards a lot of money to go in and fight the case.
Sounds like our president when he built his casinos.
Oh, you're getting started. Whole other issue. But so what recourse? I'm sorry. I didn't mean to interrupt you, Phil, but what recourse do they have in those circumstances? It sounds like it's a routine thing where they exploit this loophole, maybe, whatever you want to call it in the law, where they wait for the last 10% and say, I'm not paying.
I wouldn't say it's common, but it's more common than it should be.
Right.
And what happens is maritime lawyers locally, we generally are very sympathetic and understanding to crew members and small vendors. So if they come to us, we'll operate, reduce our fees, and find a way to help them out. And once the boat's arrested, then the owner generally pays attention.
There are currently, for the private yacht industry, those one private yacht, I'm talking about the 100-foot long ones, you know, that you see at those magnificent international boat shows that we all love but we can't afford. You know, they're $10, $20 million. But there's over 90,000 here in just southeast Florida that work in that industry, you know, focusing on the private yacht industry. That's not covering the ports or the cruise or the cargo ships or, you know, even those of us who've owned boats in the past.
Phil, Fort Lauderdale, I think, is certainly the motor yacht center of the eastern United States. I think Annapolis may be the sailboat center. But motor yachts are really focused here.
Robert, do you own a boat?
No, I've
your friends own boats, right?
Right.
Smart guy. Wanted to make sure you had that.
Like Michael, like a friend that owns a boat.
Yes, you learned.
But for those that are listening that maybe work within the industry that have an issue, maybe they know somebody, and consultations you offer that, that's free, correct?
Sure.
What is the best way to contact you?
You can call me at 954-556-1480. Or email at R as in Robert, D as in dog, M as in Macintosh, at MacintoshSchwartz.com.
Right. Being that they're on the water, can they send a signal flare for you? I guess not.
Well, you'll be hearing from me. I didn't mean to interrupt you.
Thank you, Gary Ostro, my co-host. Thank you, Phil Bell. And thank you to our guest, Bob McIntosh. And for anyone out there who is a local musician or local songwriter, you want to get your songs on our show, submit them to info@500law.com. That's info@500law.com. Legal News and Review does support local music.
Yep.
And please put down your phones, everybody. If you're in the car, listen to a radio. Don't look at your phone. You'll be home soon. And everybody remember,
be legal!
You've been listening to the award-winning Legal News and Review, recognized by the Florida Bar's Award of Excellence. Legal News and Review, featuring Michael Santucci from the law firm of Santucci Priori, located in downtown Fort Lauderdale, and practicing intellectual property, business, and entertainment law and litigation. They can be reached at 500law.com or at 954-351-7474. To contact the legal panel hosts and guests, go to BeLegalBuzz.com. And to reach Gary Singer, board-certified real estate and syndicated columnist, appearing in 400 media outlets, including the front page of the Money Section every Monday in the Sun Sentinel, from the law firm of Gary M. Singer, PA, call 954-851-1448 for Legal News and Review. Remember, be legal.
Do you need an attorney? Call someone you can trust. The Broward County Bar Association, a not-for-profit organization, was founded in 1925 to foster courtesy, ethics, and professionalism, as well as to provide necessary legal services throughout South Florida. The Broward County Bar Association, 3,000 members strong, has attorney members that work throughout the entire state of Florida, as well as nationally and internationally. Remember, the Broward County Bar Association is a referral you can count on. Call the Broward County Bar Association at 954-764-8310 for all your legal needs. A referral you can count on. 954-764-8310 or contact online at browardbar.org. Non-lawyer spokesperson.